I think most Americans would be surprised by this factoid that private equity now owns 1/3 of private hospitals in the country, and the percent is growing. And research shows that the rate of adverse effects for patients goes up by 25% when private equity takes over. These investors also have their eyes trained on doctors' practices.
The way in healthcare to decrease your costs is to cut your staffing. So we see this over and over again, particularly in the nursing home and the healthcare facility context. You cut your staff, your nurse to patient ratio goes down. You eliminate you substitute sort of higher wage physicians and highly trained nurse practitioners with lower skilled substitutes.
Aaron Fuse Brown is a professor with the Center for Advancing Health Policy through Research at Brown University. She's an expert on the legal and policy options for addressing private equity.
When they turn to these entities and say, yes, we will accept your help, we will let you manage our practice, you know, and help us with these administrative tasks, they're really turning over the keys to the castle in terms of the heart and soul of independent practice, which is their patient relationships and their control over their own practice medicine.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Aaron Fuse Brown, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Happy to be here.
Oh, that's great. You know, we recently saw a study published in JAMA that shows that hospitals owned by private equity on average saw their total capital assets decrease by 15% 2 years after acquisition, compared to the increase of 9% for hospitals not backed by private equity. Not a great outcome. But let's start with the basics for our audience. Explain what private equity is and what role it's playing in healthcare.
Yeah, so private equity is a form of investment. It's private because it's not publicly traded, and so it doesn't have as many disclosure requirements for the Securities and Exchange Commission. And usually it's a collection of investors, sovereign wealth funds, pensions, wealthy people who contribute money and investment dollars to a fund run by a private equity fund. And these are the ones that we hear about, Blackstone, KKR, you know, these investors then collect this investment dollars from their investors, and then they use that money to draw a loan. So even though it's called private equity, these are highly leveraged investments, meaning they use that seed money to go get a loan. Usually it's about 70% debt, 30% equity, and they use that fund to go buy targets. And the targets that they look for, whether it's in healthcare or other parts of the economy, are usually mature companies. So unlike venture capital, which are looking for startups or the next big thing, private equity is targeting a mature company that could be run more efficiently, could be reorganized in some way to make more money, to bring costs down, make more money for the investors. The investors typically load the debt, the process of paying off the loan, on the target company itself. So they get money by investing and managing this new asset, whether it's a hospital system or a physician practice. And then what they keep some of the profits, and they also get management fees. They load the entity with debt, meaning that the debt is secured by the assets of the hospital system. And then usually at some point, the private equity firm is not looking to keep and run this healthcare system into the future, but rather to exit the investment within a very short period of time, usually 3 to 7 years. And they make most of their windfall at that point by what they think is their improvements in the efficiency or operations of the entity. So that is the private equity model, in short. So it's basically outside private investors looking to buy and invest in healthcare targets, usually with debt.
Aaron, that is an exceptionally clear description of what it is. And of course, the follow-up to that, I think we know that you've identified the key public policy concerns that are raised by private equity's entry into physician and hospital markets for doctors, for patients, for the healthcare system overall. But having defined what it is, go over those concerns with us. What are the concerns that you have about this from a public policy perspective?
Yeah, from a public policy perspective, I think it's clear that this investment vehicle, this type of investment that is short term, highly leveraged with debt, And where the investor exits the investment within a short period of time leads to several risks to patients, to healthcare providers in the system, and to the public sort of public dollars. So that is that the private equity investor is very risk tolerant, meaning that they are willing to come in and their goal is to cut costs and raise profits in a very short period of time. That's how they're not transforming healthcare. They're not going to in 2 years, you know, turn a struggling healthcare system into one that is wildly profitable. The way they do it is they do so through financial engineering tactics. So let's pick hospitals as an example. So the Steward Healthcare system that we know declared bankruptcy earlier this year was earlier owned by and invested by a private equity company. And private equity used the same playbook for that health system as it has done in other hospital acquisitions. And that is they bought the Steward Healthcare system and then immediately sold the best asset, the most valuable asset that the hospital system had, its hospital buildings and real estate, to a real estate investment trust. So it made money in the process of selling off the asset. And then that real estate investment trust, that entity, leases back the hospital bricks and mortar that the hospital used to own itself. And so then it can escalate those lease payments, increase those lease payments over time, which is ultimately what bankrupted the Steward healthcare system. So that is one way that they say that they're injecting capital, but what they're doing is really removing assets from the health system for their own benefit so that they make a ton of transaction fees. They get to keep the profits. They get to collect the higher rent. So this is all part of their money-making, profit-generating strategy. The other way that private equity makes money that threatens public policy is through the need to create a large difference between that increasing profit margin and a decreasing costs, operating costs. The way in healthcare to decrease your costs is to cut your staffing. So we see this over and over again, particularly in the nursing home and the healthcare facility context. You cut your staff, your nurse to patient ratio goes down. You eliminate you substitute sort of higher wage physicians and highly trained nurse practitioners with lower skilled substitutes. And so what that turns into is a lower sort of employee compensation payroll, but it means worse patient care in many instances. And I think that is what we see is leading to the greater risks of mortality and adverse events for hospital and nursing home patients after private equity acquisition. So that is a big concern, is both the cost cutting is a concern and the asset stripping is another concern from public policy standpoint.
I would say in addition to Steward hospital systems in Connecticut, Prospect Medical looms large in lots of similar situations. And yet we hear from the American Investment Council, which says that private equity funded innovations have delivered more effective treatments and saved lives. They say they're also helped lower healthcare costs and increase access to care. I'm wondering, do these claims really hold up?
Yeah, I think that you know, that certainly is the promise when a private equity investor comes to approaches a health system. It's usually because the health system is somewhat vulnerable or struggling financially. And so the promise of this, again, injection of capital or resources into the health system is very attractive. And the private equity investor promises innovation, investments. And instead, what we see is exactly the opposite. There's a disinvestment, a stripping not only of assets and personnel, but also the threat of closures. What we're seeing is the Steward hospitals, you know, several of them are planning to close because they cannot seem to find a way to financially operate in the black. And so I think that the access issue, I don't see any evidence that access is improved. And in terms of cost cutting, you know, it might be cost cutting because the staffing levels go down or certain volumes of less profitable services are reduced. But that doesn't necessarily translate into the care that community needs. It doesn't help that community access the care they need in a timely, high quality way. And if you talk to the physicians that are practicing in those affiliated and the nurses that are practicing in those hospitals and nursing homes, I think that they will attest to the fact that the morale can also be threatened by the sort of corporate takeover and the cost cutting and the sort of the corporate manager, a private equity company, is not, again, in the business of running a health system. they're in the business of making money for investors. And so that cultural clash where the professionals, but you know, fiduciary obligation to do what's best for patients comes straight and directly into conflict with the need to answer to the bottom line demands of the new owner or operator.
And this is not about the long-term best interest of the organization, which regular capital might be interested in. This is really about this time horizon that is so truncated, not thinking about the lives of patients over the long term, but really thinking about returns in a very short time, which really is one of the key drivers of all this change in transactions that are happening.
Yes. So the private equity investors that initially invested in the Steward healthcare system have long gone, and they've made their money and exited. And then what's left is this sort of financially struggling hospital system that is, again, threatening access. And so the private equity investor, because of that short time horizon, sort of makes money whether or not the long-term outlook is improved. It makes money whether or not the entity ends up in bankruptcy. And so I think the incentives are simply misaligned.
Well, given all of the concerns that you've pointed out, and I would think also from a lawmaker's perspective, watching what might happen when traditionally a great employer in a community, the community hospital, goes under another negative effect, not surprising that lawmakers, certainly in Massachusetts and California, are looking at limits on this, on private equity medical acquisitions, and considering requiring pre-merger reviews, debt limits. What's your analysis of these ideas? Do they go far enough? And what are other states looking at? I don't think it's limited just to Massachusetts and California at this point.
Yeah, I think that there are several mechanisms that states in particular are concerned about and that they're using and putting into place, or at least attempting to put into place. And you're right, Massachusetts and California have had bills that have advanced the farthest this legislative session, or who are planning to reintroduce it next legislative session. So, of course, Massachusetts is, you know, where several of the Steward hospitals exist, and California. So what Massachusetts' bill sought to do is to increase the oversight over healthcare transactions that already exists in the state and expand that oversight to include acquisitions of physician practices by private equity investors that might be too small or too, you know, somehow fall between the cracks of the prior definitions of transaction oversight. And another thing that Massachusetts specifically does is to make that real estate transaction, the stripping of assets from a healthcare entity, itself a notifiable material change transaction that would require review by the Health Policy Commission and ultimately the Attorney General's office. So I think that those are two closures of healthcare systems. All of those things, each of them are one of those examples of, it's not just mergers and acquisitions anymore of hospital buying hospital down the street. It's about these other types of investment vehicles and the types of transactions they engage in once they operate the hospital system that can be problematic. So that's Massachusetts. And I think one of the things California is doing, it also has previously implemented a transaction oversight law, but that transaction oversight law is in a California bill supposed to really expand particular oversight when private equity tries to buy a healthcare entity, a physician practice, and expand the sort of oversight, but also the restrictions on what a private equity practice can do to control physicians. So I think when in the physician context, one of the concerns is that this sort of for-profit motive, again, conflicts with the physician's professional and ethical obligations. And so the idea there is to say that private equity-backed physician or management organizations, MSOs, which stands for management service organizations or staffing companies, that those entities cannot sort of take control over all aspects of operation of the physician's practice to the point where it starts to interfere with the physician's clinical and professional decision making, which we, I think, are seeing and it becoming an increasing problem. So I think both of those, you know, expanding attorney general oversight over these transactions when they happen, and then even when they are allowed to go forward, these types of for existing management arrangements where private equity or for-profit actors are in control of entities, you know, revenues and assets and bottom lines and operations, to say that that cannot bleed over into professional and clinical decision making.
Well, I know we want to get into some of the regulatory issues, talk about the FTC, but Aaron, I want to just focus in on something you've written, that multi-billion dollar acquisitions by Amazon and CVS reflect a trend towards corporate investment in primary care, which could threaten equitable access to care, raise costs, and reduce physicians' clinical autonomy. And yet we hear from others, the view from Ann Greiner, chief executive of the Primary Care Collaborative, who's also been a guest on our show. She says these companies are, and I quote, infusing practices with sorely needed funds and may improve access to care for people in underserved areas. I'm wondering what your reaction is to that.
Yeah, so this isn't one. The first point that you make is, I just want to put a highlight it, and that is, it's not just private equity that is doing this sort of corporate transformation of the healthcare system. It's also publicly traded companies like Amazon retailers, like Walmart, Amazon, but also insurers. So CVS is both a retailer and a big insurer. United Healthcare, same thing. You know, both the biggest physician employer, but also the biggest PBM and one of the biggest insurance company in the country. So we have these other types of corporate entities. Again, we think of them as, you know, corporate in the sense of for-profit operating for the benefit of their investors or their shareholders, and not necessarily for the community or for the patients. And so a lot of these entities are making big investments, like multi-billion dollar investments in physician practices, in primary care practices, in home health. And maybe this is a good thing, because we know that primary care is underinvested in. You talk to any independent primary care practice, and they are struggling to make it work with the increasing administrative burden of, say, value-based care, all the data collection, all the quality metrics, all of the population health requirements that a small practice has to take on. It has to affiliate with a bigger operation in order to manage that financial risk and just manage the data collection aspect of it. So given that, we know that practices are struggling. We know that they're looking to partner with either a large health system or one of these other large entities that can help them manage this sort of new care environment that we're in. But when they turn over, when they turn to these entities and say, yes, we will accept your help, we will let you manage our practice, you know, and help us with these administrative tasks, they're really turning over the keys to the castle in terms of the heart and soul of independent practice, which is their patient relationships and their control over their own practice medicine. And I think that is the part that we have to think about, what regulatory levers are available to protect that sort of, I think, sacred physician-patient and practitioner-patient relationship, because it is bound by professional ethical obligations that corporate owners, frankly, do not owe to the patient and owe instead to their shareholders. But also, they are not the corporate managers are not the ones who've gone to medical school or nursing school. They do not understand what patients need. They're not there at the bedside. They are not there talking to the patients. And so I think that protecting that relationship is extremely important.
Well, they've, on one hand, as an insurance company, lessened the investments in primary care, which is so desperately needed. We need to get to about a 10% spread. And then the other side, they're going out and buying them on the cheap because they need capital. It would simply make a lot more sense that private primary care, which is a focus that we have and health centers around the United States have, are so important, and yet we see a diminution of the resources they're given.
Yes, and I think that the reason that primary care is an attractive investment target for these insurance companies is not because they want to, you know, again, improve primary care so much. It's because these primary care physicians come with an associated patient base. Yeah. Particularly, they also come with associated patient data, which for Medicare Advantage in particular and other sort of value-based payment arrangements means they can have access to all the diagnostic codes that they need to maximize the capitated payment revenue that they get for Medicare Advantage. So it's a very clear profit motive for the insurance companies, particularly the Medicare Advantage plans, to get into an arrangement with these primary care practices. But what we're seeing is that it's, again, not an even trade, where the primary care practice doesn't necessarily see this large infusion of resources to the benefit of their patients. Instead, they see it's largely a way that this large entity can then access their patient data and information.
Margaret, I think we saw recently that, you know, a previous show that 54% of all Medicare patients were on Medicare Advantage now, a growing number.
Sure. And Medicare is certainly the CMS folks, as Aaron knows well, CMS folks are not immune to taking a hard look at that. And we wonder if there'll be some changes in the coming months. But Aaron, I think you're doing a great job of shedding some transparency on this whole area. But when it comes down to it, how does a consumer learn the details about the type of plan they might be joining or what is happening with their own primary care provider practice? How apparent is this to somebody if they want to make a choice? How is it apparent to an employer who sponsors health insurance for their employees and wants to make a choice with this in mind? Are the details fairly public, or does it really require somebody with your research skills to get to the bottom of the ownership of the practices or the plans they may be choosing to go with?
Well, I can guess from the way you've asked the question that ideally it would be transparent, right? That someone who's shopping for a doctor or who's looking for a new practice would be able to tell, is my practice primary, you know, is it independent or is it private equity owned? Is it owned by Optum or is it, you know, is it owned by my insurance company? And unfortunately, that is an extremely opaque and difficult piece of information to find. It is almost impossible for an individual patient or even an employer purchaser to find out who owns and who's controlling the physician practice with whom, you know, I'm getting into a relationship with, whether it's they're part of my provider network or they're going to be my primary care physician. And so that is really difficult because it's also hard for researchers to figure out which of the 90,000 physicians that Optum claims to be affiliated with and managing, who are they? Which 90,000 physicians across the country? It's very, very difficult to see that information, even in the most sophisticated data sets. It takes painstaking manual matching. And even then, it is not totally comprehensive. So not only is it difficult for the individual patient to make informed decisions, even if they understand that there are risks associated with this, they cannot make those decisions. Regulators and enforcers cannot find this information. And researchers, we cannot shed light on the problem because it's very difficult, or it makes it harder to shed light on the problem and study, what is the effect of Optum buying my physician practice? Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? Are there risks to me? It's difficult to answer that question because we can't even figure out which physicians are Optum affiliated, which physicians are, you know, we painstakingly have to manually come up with lists of providers that are private equity affiliated in order to study that effect. But that takes time, it takes resources, and it's not something that is certainly not available to the average, you know, patient out there.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, a couple of regulatory issues, and let me sort of mush them together here. On one hand, you've got some state activities going on, and then you have some federal. There's a state law that prohibits what's called corporate medicine. And of course, these statutes prevent a company that employs doctors from interfering with patient treatment. And wondering what your thoughts about the strength of those laws. And then you've got the FTC working on the non-compete clause. And I think that a federal judge blocked that the other day. And maybe talk a little bit about this, but just to let our audience know that we've got action at state levels. And I think, Aaron, you talked a little bit about Massachusetts and California, but you also have actions at the federal level. So maybe try to address them both, but also in this larger framework of what is out there in terms of oversight that might be in place.
Yeah, so I think the concern that all of these federal and state regulatory actions, the corporate practice of medicine, the federal and state equivalent non-compete bans, are really getting at this idea of corporate control over physician and clinician decision-making. And that is at the heart of this concern, is that traditionally and for many, many years, there's been this concept that lay unlicensed corporations that have, again, owe their primary obligation to their shareholders, do not have the right financial interests and right training to be interfering with or dictating to a physician how they should practice medicine. So for a long time, there have been on the books in many states these prohibitions on lay unlicensed corporations owning, employing, or controlling physicians in the practice of medicine. And of course, this has also been extended to independent practitioners like nurse practitioners and physician assistants. So what does that look like in practice? However, it just has invited clever lawyers to contractually work around it so that physicians look on paper to be employed by professional corporations and other physician-controlled entities, and then contractually get into relationships, whether it's with hospitals or management service organizations for administrative and operational support. You know, physicians don't want to do their own billing and collection, for example. So over time, these administrative back-end service providers are called management service organizations, MSOs, have become more than just the backroom administrative support organization. Rather, they have started to take over the keys again to the practice. In this case, physicians turn over not only their billing and collection and their payer contracting and their hiring and firing and their supervision and their leases and their equipment ordering and their supply ordering, but really all of the clinical protocols, the scheduling, the amount of time they get to spend with patients, which patients they get to see and for how long. All of these things start to really impede and interfere with the profession and the practice of medicine and clinical judgment. And so what states and the federal government are trying to do is to untangle, while leaving some of these support mechanisms in place, these relationships in place, to really create a structural divide between those who are empowered to practice medicine and those who provide operational administrative supports, to say that there are certain types of arrangements that you cannot enter into because essentially that would cause you to seize control over the practice of medicine. And so states like Oregon, Massachusetts are trying to strengthen their corporate practice of medicine prohibition to make it so that it's more difficult to contractually work around it and for an insurance company or an MSO that's private equity owned to really, again, acquire the keys to a practice contractually through these types of management service organization arrangements. Similarly, the non-compete ban that happened at the federal level, the FTC, but also have been on the books and are being added to laws at the state level every year, is getting at the same concern. And that is that non-competes, which tell a physician, you cannot work in a 50-mile radius or 25-mile radius of any of the practice locations of your employer for a period of up to 2 years after you depart the employer for any reason. That is a very onerous restriction. It's a restrictive covenant that is put into the employment agreement. And increasingly, of course, physicians are employed. They are not operating their own practices. And so these physicians feel utterly chilled, utterly silenced by the inability, by their non-compete, their gag clauses, their non-disclosure agreements. They cannot speak out if they feel that the practice is being run in an unethical or unprofessional way. They cannot leave because they are bound by a non-compete. They would have to move their family two states over in order to escape the confines of their non-compete or stop practicing for several years. Again, these are not practical realities for most practicing physicians. So the existence of non-competes, again, really prevents physicians from practicing medicine in an independent and autonomous way because they're locked in essentially to their existing arrangements. So these two in combination, strengthening the corporate practice of medicine, prohibition, and those protections at the state level, it's traditionally been done at the state level, and regulating or restricting non-competes for employed physicians, again, traditionally at the state level, and then more recently through a federal non-compete ban, are seen as ways to protect professional health practitioners from corporate control and protect their autonomy and their clinical decisions from corporate interference. So as you alluded to, the federal non-compete ban was slated to go into effect shortly in September of this year. The rule was finalized earlier in April of this year. And immediately, of course, there were three lawsuits challenging the non-compete ban. The non-compete ban by the FTC didn't just apply to physicians. It did apply to physicians, but it applied to sort of workers across the economy. And so the Chamber of Commerce in Texas and several other different business groups sued under various federal laws to say that the FTC's non-compete ban was invalid. And in fact, they got the federal judge in Texas to agree and issue a nationwide injunction just last week, saying that the FTC lacks the statutory authority to impose a ban on non-competes and that should stop the implementation and enforcement of the non-compete ban nationwide. Of course, there are competing cases. The federal court in Florida signaled that it probably will agree with the Texas court. Mm-hmm. And then there's another case in Pennsylvania, which went the opposite way and said, no, the FTC has the authority to issue the non-compete ban. Well, what does this mean for the, you know, the regular physician who's sitting there with their own non-compete ban? Like, is it still enforceable? Is it not? It is still enforceable. And, you know, I think that the federal challenges means that at least for the time being, the FTC's rule will not go into effect. But you would have to also check with state law, because more states are entertaining the idea of either enforcing or passing similar non-compete bans particularly for physicians in their state. So California has a non-compete ban. Indiana passed one particularly for primary care physicians. And so increasingly states are interested in this as well. So even while we're waiting for litigation, I think ultimately the Supreme Court will need to decide what the status of the FTC's non-compete ban will be, and that, you know, may not go so well for the FTC. But here again, states can fill in a gap that the federal government's, even while there's a legal challenge to the federal FTC's non-compete ban, states can pass one at the state level, and that can offer similar, if not broader, protection for practicing physicians and clinicians within, and nurses and other types of healthcare workers within their borders. And I think that is where we increasingly see the action being held. But again, it's all to this eye of protecting autonomy, protecting professional clinical judgment, and protecting the rights of workers who are increasingly feeling squeezed by corporate ownership.
Let me just get one last question about the election, sure, since it's right around the corner. I'm wondering, how do the presidential candidates stack up on the issues that we've been talking about, and have they been transparent enough on these issues?
Yeah, I think, in some ways, healthcare has not been at the center of the political debates as it has in prior elections. I think that there are other concerns, that are taking up the space that health policy typically does. I don't know exactly where the candidates have aligned in terms of on some of the issues that we're talking about. Some of them are fairly bipartisan in the sense that everyone seems to be equally for increasing transparency. That seems to have a lot of support on both sides of the aisle, at least in Congress. And I would imagine that's similar. The Trump administration put in some of the hospital and transparency and coverage rules, for example. So some of those things are not necessarily partisan in valence. But again, transparency doesn't get you all the way there. It just gives you the data so you can study the effects. It doesn't solve the problem. And on the more important issue, I think one thing to watch is to see where the candidates stack up on their antitrust and enforcement and competition policy. I think that there we see a little bit more of a partisan divide, where the Trump-appointed judges and the sort of Trump-era FTC commissioners are more skeptical of their power, for example, to do things like the non-compete ban, to take aggressive action against the type of healthcare consolidation and acquisitions that FTC Chair Lina Khan and the Biden administration's FTC commissioners and DOJ and competition policy. There's a tri-agency work group, for example, across HHS, the Department of Justice, and FTC, very, very pro competition policy, a strong antitrust enforcement approach, and it remains to be seen whether or not Vice President Harris will continue that trajectory or whether she will take a different approach. And so I think that's an interesting place to watch, is just to see where the candidates fall when it comes to antitrust enforcement and competition policy.
And your thought about the FTC commissioner in terms of the work she's done?
I think that the FTC commissioner, Chair Khan, but also, the commissioners, Rebecca Kelly Slaughter and Bedoya, have been very, I think in some ways, very forward thinking. It's been a breath of fresh air. They've taken several important steps in the area of private equity enforcement. There's, the big antitrust case against the U.S. Anesthesia Partners that the FTC brought in Texas, which is a huge, I think a huge move. The updated merger enforcement policies that the FTC and the DOJ co-issued in 2023, and the FTC non-compete rule. I think in some ways the leadership of the FTC has been a very, and the Department of Justice have been very pointed, very aggressive and pro-competition in a way that's sort of meaningful. It's not sort of stuck in the past, but is looking at the ways in which we see new consolidation, new anti-competitive conduct being played out in sort of the current market, not just sort of the market of the 1950s, 60s, 70s. So I think that that's been, you know, I would like to see that trajectory continued.
Well, Aaron Fuse Brown, this has been a fascinating and important conversation. And I think we look forward to having you back on the show as things evolve over the coming months during this most interesting year and the year to come. Thank you for your time. Thank you to our audience for being here. Please be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X with our account name CHC Radio. As always, go online to chcradio.com to sign up for email updates. And please share your thoughts, comments, and reactions about the program. Aaron, thank you so much for the important work that you're doing and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.